by for Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with your host, Drew Kirby.
Hey, this is Luke Holmes.
I am Morgan Wallen.
I'm Riley Green.
I'm Travis Denning.
Hey, I'm Aaron Lewis.
Hey, it's Luke Bryan.
I'm Tim McGraw.
What's up? This is Ian Munsick.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
And we're back for another great episode of Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. And we're continuing our aquatic series with John and Janet from Wyoming Game and Fish Department. And Janet, last week we learned a lot, and really it's interesting. I looked a little more into like the beaver dams and how we use that knowledge to benefit everything. And it's so cool that you can use that type of methodology to make things work out.
Absolutely. And Drew, for those listeners who maybe didn't hear last week, as an encouragement to maybe go back and take a listen, we talked to John about some projects that we call beaver dam analogs, right? So it's where John gets to be the beaver and he gets to go out and make these artificial beaver dams out on tributaries or other areas like Bolton Creek that flow into the North Platte River. And that really helps trap sediment to help improve the river. And like we talked about last week, we all know the importance of the North Platte River to the community of Casper and folks that depend on it for their livelihood. And so really just the little efforts of John being a busy beaver turns out to really help the community a ton, and people may not even realize it.
Well, we also learned that the projects, even the smaller projects, still take a long time to get the ball rolling and from start to finish. So it really is a process.
Absolutely. And this Bolton Creek project that we were talking about has been going on for a very long time. And John just continues to refine and build on and continue to make such fantastic improvements that really help the habitat. And today we'll talk about some that maybe take a little bit longer even than some of the stuff that these lower, we kind of call the project last week, we can kind of call lower technology, right? Because it's John being the beaver out there doing some handwork and getting this analog beaver dam analog put in, where now maybe today we're going to talk about stuff that maybe isn't quite as simple and takes a little bit longer to get done on the ground and maybe a little bit more technology.
John, would you call this a middle of the road project?
Yeah, for sure. There's middle of the road ones, and then there's ones that, you know, require a heck of a lot of engineering and math and making sure everything makes sense. So yeah, we've got the gamut, but for sure, yeah, today we can talk about ones that are maybe, they're not overly complex, but also it takes a little bit more planning and design and taking current conditions into account in a large river.
And so maybe if we're just being all punny, we shouldn't call it middle of the road. Maybe we should call it middle of the river.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. So middle of the river today is the topic.
Well, John, give us a quick rundown of what a middle of the road river project would consist of. And, you know, we talked about how last time you start, you know, coming up with projects and doing your budgeting and everything through the winter, and then you're hopefully boots on the ground by fall. Are these projects a little bit longer to get started?
They are, yeah. They require a little bit more planning, a little bit more funding, more time and design, as I mentioned. Because, yeah, they're working on a larger system and the stakes are a little bit higher. So this is specifically in rivers like the North Platte River. We do, you know, work in a lot of other comparable sized rivers around the state, you know, the Bighorn, the Green, the New Fork. But specifically where I'm working is the North Platte. And yeah, it requires a little more planning. And most of that work is revolved around sediment again. So I don't want to give sediment a bad rap. Sediment's very important for rivers to maintain themselves. There has to be a stable, steady amount of sediment that flows through the water at high flows, and that keeps rivers steady, right? Some of that sediment lays out and other sediment washes downstream. When you have too little of sediment, well, you get a downcutting effect because there's nothing to replace the sediment. And when you have too much, sediment, why then the riverbed starts to rise or a grade. And anytime you have infrastructure or cities, towns, houses, whatever around rivers that are moving and not stable, why that's a problem, because that creates an issue for homeowners and property owners with land loss, with erosion, with potential damage. So we have a real desire to create stable conditions in rivers. And it also just so happens, us being a game and fish agency, that stable, healthy rivers also make really good fish habitat. So that's where we come in as an agency. Our main goal is to improve fishing. But like I said, a lot of time there's these other benefits that come from improving the river and the fish habitat. So that's where we get that benefit through stability for all these other folks out on the landscape.
So when it comes to something like the North Platte River, which obviously fishing is a major part of there, but there's also recreation where people go and they'll float the river. And this all, I assume, plays a role in that game, too.
It does, for sure. And having healthy, stable rivers is actually it's pretty important for folks floating and recreating in that way. It was just last weekend, I was out fishing with my family on a section of river that was particularly in size and had pretty steep banks. And, you know, a group of folks had capsized their raft. They were in a stock tank, actually. They had capsized and they were in trouble. Some of them couldn't swim. Their life jackets weren't up. So we had to go out and fish them out. But they couldn't get up on the banks because they were too steep and eroding. And that just really highlighted to me, like, wow, like we're coming at this for the fish, for the sediment transport, for the stability, but it's also a safety concern too. I mean, a lot of times folks who are recreating in maybe less obvious ways, like inner tubing or boating, like if you get out into the water, it can be a real safety hazard. So there's a huge benefit for recreational users in that way as well.
So John, is that how you will find these bigger projects, is just getting your eyes on situations like that? Because I'm sure that in your mind now, you already have a plan of, okay, we need to go back and look at this situation. And is it something that needs to be addressed as soon as possible?
Yeah, for sure. A lot of times that is what brings your attention to it. And luckily for this given reach, you know, the city of Casper is already working at doing a river restoration project throughout that area. So yeah, it's been long identified as an area it's got a lot of erosion. The river's moved around a lot in the last, 50, 60 years. It's had some real stability issues. But for sure, when I'm out looking for projects, you can kind of tell when you see a bank, if it doesn't look good, you know, we then go in and do further refined measurements and see how much sediment's coming off of it, how much vegetation's on it. What's the angle of that bank? Is it a sheer bank? Is it a really, you know, gradual bank angle that maybe can support vegetation? So we look at all those things, and that kind of hones us into what areas need work. And it's the ones that are contributing the most fine sediment typically lend themselves to needing the most work stabilizing them. And what I set out to do when I first got here, it's been about 6 years now. I got with some of the fish biologists and we just floated the river. And anytime we came across a bank that was eroding, why we'd take a waypoint, we'd do some measurements, take some pictures, and we just kind of put it in a log. And we later went back and kind of ranked them all out on what's the most severe eroding, what's the least, what's something we could maybe, you know, not do, what's something we need to do. And it was great. We were able to then put that data in with where's the most spawning happens. And it really gave us a great idea of where to start looking to do work and where we can have the greatest impact.
So if you have a list that long, you know, you went out, you created, say, 20 waypoints on one trip. When will be the next time you go out and do another trip like that to keep your eyes on those and see other problem areas?
Well, that's a great point. Yeah, we did it for 3 years and we were able to float from Gray Reef down to Casper. And we got most of the areas that are within, like, I think what we'd call our main fishing areas. There's fishing that happens downstream of town, but a lot of our top areas are Gray Reef section, right down to Casper. And you're also right. There's always, rivers are dynamic and they're always changing. We've had one project that we're working on now that's popped up since that survey, and it's a direct threat to infrastructure and access. And we've diverted efforts right to that right away because it's the area of need. So, you know, a plan's great. Plan's great to have until it gets you started, but a lot of times necessity diverts you other places. And that's kind of where we're at. But I do think it's good to have an idea and a general, you know, plan of attack for how you want to improve the river.
So you talk about an older generation come back and sees the projects that he was working on still in the process. How much does technology and the changing times help in really identifying the issues and speeding the process up?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And certainly, you know, the river restoration field, I guess you could call it, has developed quite a bit in the last 50, 60 years. You know, it started out, you know, a lot of times we're just trying to make localized fish habitat, right? And that was kind of it, that the infancy of river restoration, you know, it was like, oh, fishing's maybe not as good as it needs to be. Let's try and put a structure in, or this bank's eroding. Let's throw some riprap on it. Or, you know, you see some old school restorations, people would put old cars in riverbanks, right? And we call that Detroit riprap. But yeah, and since then we've kind of begun to evolve to maybe a little more refined and very similar to the same notion that we talked about last week. We often look to nature to see what works in natural areas that are, you know, kind of unimpacted and maybe have shown stability over the years. And we'll take cues from what we see there, and then we try and mimic that on the landscape today. So, you know, a lot of these early projects, they've shown good success and they are working. But we're always refining and getting better. And I think the more we can aim towards mimicking what we can observe in natural healthy areas and putting those into areas that need help, I think that's going to give us the most bang for our buck. And we're going to get it to a point where it's self-sustaining and takes care of itself and needs less, you know, input, less money, less maintenance. Because really that's what we want. You know, we don't want to be tending to these things. We want them to take off on their own. We want natural stabilizing riparian vegetation to come in, willows and cottonwoods, create that wildlife habitat, but also hold those riverbanks in solid and, you know, create a good, stable environment that benefits all parties, you know.
Very cool. All right, John, hang on just a second. We're going to pause for just a few minutes, take a little break, and we're back with John McCoy from Wyoming Game and Fish Department talking about aquatic habitat and some of those projects.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Talking with John McCoy and Janet Millick from Wyoming Game and Fish about aquatic habitat projects that are going on. And as always, if you missed last week's episode, you can listen again at the radio station's app on demand. John, in a situation, say you have a bank that really is starting to erode away and things are really starting to be sketchy, what's the process that you'll go through? I mean, obviously you'll keep your eyes on it, then you start putting a plan into place. What would be a potential plan for something like that?
Yeah, you know, I think the first step is to, yeah, get some sort of a measurement on it. You know, you can do a real direct measurement where you'll put like a pin on a bank, right? And you can measure how much sediment is lost over the course of a year. Sometimes you can see that happening right before your eyes and you can say, we don't need to measure this, we can see it happening, and you get right to work. So at that point, once you've identified it, then the first step you always want to do is take a step back and look at the landscape. You know, are you in a big, open, wide valley like we have on the North Platte, you know, maybe closer to town? Or are you in like a constrained, steep, rocky valley like what you have in, say, Cardwell Canyon, you know, in between Pathfinder and Alcova? That's a totally different kind of river there. It's the same river, but it's in a different landscape. So you want to take hints from what's going on around it, and that then guides how you would stabilize it. If you're in one of those rocky environments, like a canyon, like what you see in, like, say, the Wind River Canyon on the Bighorn, or you know, in Cardwell Canyon there in between Pathfinder and Alcova, you can use big rocks to stabilize an eroding area. And that's pretty much in line with what you see in nature there. But as you move out into more wide open valleys, like what you see along the Platte between Casper and Grey Reef Dam, then you can start to look to more options that go in line with more with what you see. There you want to use more vegetation to help stabilize. You look at banks that are doing really well and are stable, and you see thick willow communities and cottonwoods growing up out of them, and they're kind of messy, they're kind of dense, but they don't move, they're stable. You know, folks who have property on them will say, yeah, this bank isn't going anywhere. And a lot of times though, to get those vegetation communities to establish, you have to give it a little bit of help to get it there. And in those situations, we'll often take tree material, big old cottonwoods, or we'll even go up and get conifers from timber sales, wherever we can find them, but big trees, and we'll jam those up in the banks, and we'll create a roughness in there that breaks up that water's shear stress. And it takes that erosive ability out of it, because that water is using all its energy on the tree roots and the tree trunks. And it's not just eroding away that fine sediment that's behind them in the bank. And when you break up that erosive shear stress that's hitting on it, that gives the riparian vegetation a chance to start to recover. It doesn't get washed in every year, right? So that buys us time. You know, trees break down over the years, right? I mean, a wet tree can last a long time, but eventually, you know, it is organic matter. It's going to break down. But in the meantime, we're hoping to get very healthy, robust riparian vegetation communities to establish. And then, you know, when that tree is maybe half dirt, half tree, you know, you've got a lot of willows and cottonwoods holding it in, and it's a stable area. So yeah, we'll look to what we like to do is to look to the landscape and then see what works within that landscape type.
So really, I mean, obviously this isn't something that you can fix overnight, because all of that stuff you're talking about takes years and years and years to grow. So any temporary fix that you can put in there, like jamming the trees in there, I mean, that's something that will just hold it off until it basically grows it up itself, right?
Yeah. And, you know, holding off can be, you know, it's all on different time frames, right? Like we're hoping to get, and a lot of times, like 100 years of bank stabilization out of some of these, you know. Other cases, maybe not as much, but we're looking to create something that works for us and our temporal needs, but also works on nature's time frame, which is a heck of a lot longer, you know. It works in the hundreds of thousands of years. So right. We want to create something that works for us as people, but also works for the environment in the long term.
How long will a project like, you know, restoration take to finish? I mean, because again, yeah, it's something that's kind of ongoing, but when you find that problem area, you start working on it, how long is it going to take you?
Yeah, well, for one, it depends on the need. If it's an area that's quickly eroding and threatening infrastructure, you can get something together pretty quick. In those cases, a lot of times, you know, we can scamper around and find money to do things. And a lot of times we'll try and do projects in-house in those cases. And we can circumvent a lot of those costs in planning by doing it ourselves. Now there's a little bit of give, you know, there's a little bit of give with that, because we're not, we do have engineers on staff here, but they're not specialized engineers in river restoration. They're there to assist us in project hiring and implementation. We all have some knowledge of this, but they're not the specialists that sometimes we like to contract out to do this work. But sometimes necessity requires quick movement and to get something done, get something stabilized, right? But in situations where it's less time pressing, yeah, then we'll take a little bit longer approach. Like I said, we want to make sure we do good work. So a lot of time that starts out with, like what we said, identifying a site, then trying to determine what we need to do for funding. You know, if we're going to hire an engineering firm, a stream restoration engineering firm, that takes a little bit of money. I mean, we all know engineers aren't cheap, right? They charge quite a bit.
Right.
So we got to start to get a budget together. And typically, you know, we'll give them, 6 months to a year to come up with a good design. A lot of the work that they go out in measurement and calculations of the river channel form and whatnot, that has to be done in, you know, warm, relatively warm, nice weather. because of our rough Wyoming winters. So they go out in the seasons when they can work. And then in the winter, they do a lot of number crunching. So sometimes that can take about a year. And then, you know, we got to get our, we take that design and we go back to these funders and we say, hey, here's our design. Here's our plan. Here's the momentum we have. And here's what we're going to put it towards. Here's the, what the construction need is. And then we'll hire some of these construction companies that do and have done great river restoration work, and we'll bring them in. And, you know, once again, these contractors, they have a lot of jobs in the hopper. You know, it can take a few months to get them out on site, and you're still working within that seasonality, right? There's a good portion of the year where the Platte's up and high and running at irrigation flows, not necessarily the best for working, but then it comes down in the fall. And that's typically our window for working is in the fall when waters have come down and it's still warm enough to work. That's usually when we're getting on the ground and doing our stream stabilization construction work.
So it's just crazy how time consuming all of these projects are. You know, we talked about the lower tech ones where you go out and you're basically being a beaver. You know, maybe a little quicker than something like this on the medium size project. I can only imagine what these larger projects. Time-wise, I mean, you're probably a decade.
Yeah, I mean, some of the bigger projects, certainly. You know, the city of Casper, they've taken on a real desire to improve the North Platte River, and they're going all in on it, where they're trying to, you know, there's a lot of Platte River in the city of Casper, and they took the worst areas, and they're going to try and make them the best areas, and they've shown great success with that in the first half of this project. But it's been a long ongoing one because the planning, the funding, all that comes into play. On some of these shorter, just a bank stabilization, you know, a lot of times 2 years, it's pretty reasonable. You know, I can get a little impatient. I don't like it when it goes beyond 2 years. Sometimes three is necessity, but I'm like anybody else. I like to see projects get on the ground and get completed as efficiently as possible. Sometimes we get stuck in process because, once again, we're working with a public resource that impacts folks downstream. So we have to be careful and we have to plan accordingly and do things in a way so that it benefits everyone as opposed to hurting someone maybe downstream. And that's why, you know, there's these processes in place that we have to conform to. And it's kind of a necessary evil, I think, sometimes, but maybe not so evil. A lot of times those folks are well-intended too. So
the permitting actually probably puts timeframes around the amount of time and longevity.
So, yep. So permitting, fund planning, it all takes these projects out to these longer timeframes that we're talking about.
So we talked last week where volunteers are used a lot with the lower tech projects that you have. When you get into this medium tier, is volunteers, is that still something that is a big part of the project, or are you mostly relying on the pros for this?
You're probably right there. Most times the pros, you know, we're working with heavy equipment at this point to get a larger stretch of bank done in an efficient manner, right? But that's not to say there aren't opportunities. You could call it a moderate level of intensity. However, a lot of projects, sometimes a bank just needs to get replanted with willows, you know, and you can have a crew of folks go out, and willows are great. You can cut a piece of willow off, get about a half inch to a 1 inch diameter willow twig, and you can jam that sucker in the ground, and a certain percent of them are going to grow. Ranchers and farmers will tell you irrigation ditches. I mean, you can grow a willow quick where there's water. And that's kind of the thing, you know, if you want a willow to grow, just don't want it there. Right. But, you know, you can stick willows in the ground and they'll grow. So a lot of times we'll take these hand crews and go out and we'll try and stabilize a bank just by planting willows, sticking them in the ground and hoping they take. And then a lot of times that works. And you know, that's something maybe we didn't talk about as much. You know, of course we always want to look at what's the cheapest option first, because we want to maximize our impact on the landscape. And by that, you know, the simplest projects are a lot of times the best options. And when you can just send a crew of volunteers or even just a group of game and fish folks out for a day or two and just do a bunch of planting on a bank, you can have a pretty big impact sometimes.
Very cool. Well, it's all fascinating how the process works. John will be back next week. We have one more part of the three-part series to discuss some of the bigger projects that are in the aquatic area of Wyoming Game and Fish Department.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Drew along with Brian Woodward at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports, where summer is in full swing. We've had our hottest day of the year so far and many more on the way, Brian.
Boy, it sure looks like that. And people are out enjoying this weather. A lot of people out floating the river. And, of course, we had the fair and rodeo in town this last week. And it's just been a kind of a neat little buzz going around town.
I've been seeing a lot of people floating the river and a lot of people posting pictures. That's something I've never really done or even been interested in. Mm-hmm. Well, first off, I don't have the stuff that I need to have, but you can get that here.
Yeah, we've got a lot of like inner tubes. We've got stand-up paddle boards. We have some rafts. We've got the life jackets, which is really all you really need. You know, just get the life jacket, yeah. Feet down, go for it. But yeah, we got the stuff to get you out there and have a good time. We've got some paddles and oars, and you know. Just, you know, it is a kind of a fun, nice, relaxing way to just spend an afternoon.
Yeah, and outside of getting your supplies to go, I mean, there's not much cost involved with floating. You just float.
You just float, you know. Have somebody park one vehicle down at the bottom and someone park up on top and shuttle each other around and, yeah, have a great time.
You know, I know that here at the store you guys are always bringing in the new stuff for the next season, and we just talked a couple of weeks ago about how the camping gear that you have is fully stocked and full on right now.
Yeah, a lot of Traegers going out the door. People, you know, doing a lot of grilling. A lot of guys with the portable stuff that are looking for, you know, those portable Coleman grills that you can take out and cook a steak or burgers or brats, mm-hmm. whatever you're doing. We got propane fuel. A lot of just great camping accessories, whether it's chairs, cots, pads, that kind of stuff. Tents, water bottles, water jugs. I mean, you name it, we've got it.
Of course, trekking poles and even the hiking boots and shoes that you need on there, too.
Yeah, sunscreen, bug spray, you know, anything that you're going to need to get outdoors, we've got it.
You know, one of the things, and I think we kind of joked about this before, but people have come in and been surprised that there weren't, you know, bats and balls or, you know, footballs everywhere.
Yeah, we'll leave that to some of those big box stores, but yeah, we're going to be the, you know, the outdoor hunting, fishing, camping, and the shooting sports. And we've seen a lot of people, you know, coming in and buying clay target throwers, clay targets, shotgun loads, you know, just it's a great opportunity and great time to get your kids out and kind of teach them some gun safety and get out there and play around a little bit.
Yeah, and, you know, we've talked about this also, but if you're going to hunt big game this fall or maybe you're going to hunt ducks and geese or turkeys, you know, you guys have the biggest selection of guns in Wyoming.
Yeah, we just had the second draw for Wyoming Game and Fish, mm-hmm. for big game tags. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of people that have finally drawn their tag that they wanted, or they have a tag that they're wanting to upgrade their gun. We're seeing a lot of guys coming in with scopes, needing scopes mounted. They need them bore sighted just to get out to the range or get out to the open, some BLM land to do their sighting in.
So come on by here and check them out at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about, the camping, but if you're going to go to a state park, you got to have the state park pass and the camping pass. So you might as well come in. You can get those here, too.
Yeah, and we've had quite a few people that have, I guess, been kind of confused on the process. You know, you can do it from you can kind of get your profile and stuff set up from home. But it's almost just as easy to, if you haven't done it before, come on in. You know, we've done hundreds of them at this point. We'll get you set up in the system, whether you need a day use pass or a camping permit or both. We can get you, walk you through that process. Also, those ORV tags. You know, a lot of people are getting those side-by-sides and ATVs out, whether on Casper Mountain or the Bighorns. You need to make sure you have your ORV sticker. So when you come on into the store, just have your make, model, and VIN number, and we'll get you set up, and you'll be out the door pretty quickly.
Once you do that one time, are you set up for future use on that?
Well, unless they've changed their program or their system, which they did just this last year. So I think the first system that they had a couple of years ago got revamped, and so the two systems didn't merge, and so now we're having to create all new profiles for people. So that's the complicated part of it. But anyways, it's easy once you come into the store.
Well, get on in here, check it out. And if you're going to go on one of those ORV trips and you like a paper map, you guys have maps of a lot of trails and stuff.
We do have a lot of the trail maps. We also carry the BLM maps and, of course, the Wyoming Atlas. So between those three, you can pretty much get anywhere in the state.
And maybe you want to go the tech route. You guys have the GPS systems.
Right. We carry all the Garmins that have a lot of the topos on them that kind of show you the trails and whatnot. If you're looking for a special unit that maybe Garmin sells, like one of the treads that you're going to want to mount inside of your side-by-side, we don't generally carry them in stock, but we can certainly order them for you and get those shipped to the store.
Well, get over here and check it out. If you want anything for the outdoors, this is your one-stop shop at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
And we're back at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports, where, of course, you can come in and get yourself fishing license or fishing gear and get out and do some fishing. We've been doing a lot with the Wyoming Walleye Stampede, and we're down to the championship in the first couple weeks of March or August. March, I'm going back in time here. I don't know what's going on. I've been drinking
cooler
already.
Weather.
but fishing really has been kind of an interesting time this year.
Well, it's definitely different. I mean, obviously, when we're fishing these reservoir systems, water levels affect what the fish are doing and how they're responding. And not only water levels, but you've got forage issues. And there's some lakes that, you know, the fish quality look great, and the fishing's been better than it's probably ever been. And then there's other lakes like Glendo that we've just been accustomed to going down there and being able to catch fish just about any which way you want. Right. And it's been a little more challenging this year.
You know, I was up on Casper Mountain, you know, as you come down at the little lookout there, and boy, it is brown and dry. So I assume a lot of the waterways are kind of getting beat up over that too.
Yeah, I mean, there's just there wasn't as much runoff or as much snowpack as we probably would have wanted or needed, you know, not only in Wyoming, but a lot of our water comes from northern Colorado, and I think they struggled as well. So it is just what it is, you know, and unfortunately we're going to, you know, the cyclic nature of nature is that we're going to have some drought years and we're going to have some great years. And anyways, there's still plenty of good fishing to be had. Let's put it that way.
Right. So if someone – we talk a lot about the river and the reservoirs because that's basically what we have around here. Mm-hmm. But if someone wanted to go and check something out in the state, like, what are other options that they have that you've fished?
Oh, boy. I mean, Keyhole Reservoir, Buffalo Bill up around that Cody area. There's High Tack. There's a lot of – I mean, just small reservoirs and lakes, and, you know, depending on what you're wanting to fish for, you know, Tony Kaiser that we've had on the show quite a bit. He's doing some guiding on some day trips for some fly fishing up into like the southern bighorns around Gem Lake, where they've got golden trout and some of that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're up for something different, I mean, there is a lot of, you know, different opportunities. And if you know, you go to the Game and Fish office, I mean, they can kind of guide you as to what different reservoirs, you know, if you need to, you know, maybe a mile walk, or if you want to walk in a little bit further, a 5 mile hike, or if you want to jump in with Tony and go on horseback and go in, you know, 8 miles, you could do that as well.
I mean, I'm not much on the horse, so I think I'll stick to the close one.
yeah. No, I mean, I enjoy some of that stream fishing, you know, the southern bighorns, when you're, you know, catching all those little brookies and stuff. That's pretty fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for local stuff where you can just, you know, jump on a boat or find a nice shoreline and actually be able to catch walleyes and trout, there's quite a few of those opportunities just in the area.
When you were out fishing, because you did the circuit for quite a while, and you fished all over the place, and, you know, I kind of asked you one time some of the better places, that what were some of the surprising places that you have fished?
Well, you know, the, one of my favorite places is Devil's Lake, North Dakota. You know, it's about a 10-hour drive from Casper. It has a lot of unique structures. You know, it's not big and rocky. It's a natural lake. I mean, it has basically just consumed tons of farmland. There's farmhouses underwater.
Oh, really?
There's islands where farm equipment is still on, so you can go over it with your graph and still see like a tractor.
Oh,
and it used to have just a ton of trees where, like, you know, the slip bobber bite was fun, where you could, you know, in a hot middle of a hot summer day, get in those trees, stay out of the heat, and those walleyes would just kind of work along the shoreline, and you'd see a guy 100 yards away from you get a bite, and then the guy at 50 yards away from you bite, and you're like, okay, get ready, here comes the walleyes, and they're just schooling through. Myself and a couple of my buddies are going to go up to Devil's Lake in September, and so we're going to spend 5 days up there. That's one of my favorites that's close. Of course, the Missouri River, anywhere along, you know, Lake Owyhee or Chamberlain or Francis Case or any of those places can be awesome. A little bit different navigating that those bodies of water just because it's a river system. And so not really a problem on Owyhee, but when you get downriver, sometimes like the river gets a little bit skinnier, not as deep. It's pretty common for them to be running a boat, you know, full speed in 8 foot of water. Oh. Where around here, we get in 8 foot of water, we're like, oh gosh, what's happening? But there's a lot of great places. You know, I've been all the way to the Mississippi River. That was pretty unique and pretty cool. Fishing wing dams and that type of stuff. We fished tailwaters of pool 8, 9, and 10, and that was phenomenal fishing as well. Gosh, let me think. You know, of course, McConaughey's close by over in Nebraska. Minotaur's a smaller lake just outside of Scotts Bluff. The Colorado's got it's a handful of stuff, but I'm a little bit busier with the traffic and a few more rules than I like to follow. but yeah, there's a lot of places that a main person could explore.
And that's kind of another one of the interesting parts is when you cross state lines, things are going to be different. You know, you go to Colorado, it's way different than if you go to South Dakota, and then you come back to Wyoming, and it's even, you know, more different. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, and like I said, you know. When I was fishing the circuit, you know, a lot of times, you know, you want to try to figure out what the locals are doing. So you go to the local bait shop, you see kind of what they're stocking, get an idea of, you know, presentation wise. You know, we do a lot of pitching plastics and jigs and that type of stuff around here, and we can do it year round in a lot of cases. You go to some of these other parts of the country and you're like, man, a walleye's a walleye. They should be able to hit this swim bait or this jerk bait or whatever you're doing. And it just doesn't always seem like it works that way. And, you know, you get up to like Green Bay and some of those bigger bodies of water up in Michigan and that kind of stuff. You know, you're fishing super clear water, you know, 25, 30 foot visibility. You're looking for structure, sunken humps and that kind of stuff where the fish are going to congregate around. And you're using, you know, a lot of more like ice fishing presentations where you're using jigging wraps and vertical baits and that type of stuff. So, yeah, it's been kind of fun just to play around and see, you know, the different parts of the country and the different presentations and how people are fishing. Yeah, it's great just to get out.
You know, I just thinking about, you know, going to all those different locations, and if you didn't have like the electronics to see what's going on underwater, it'd be a tough thing to really find out where
to
fish.
20 years ago, we really didn't have much. You know, you had a map. You know, and so I've got a handful of paper maps from a lot of these lakes because, you know, that's all we had. But yeah, the technology now with the map chips and, you know, even just a handheld GPS, right, giving you kind of, you know, topographical structure, right. You know, these lake chips are giving you contours and kind of giving you ideas on where, you know, where the sandbar was when they originally did the surveying. But yeah, the technology anymore, you can pretty much navigate just about any body of water without too much problems.
And probably up your chances of catching some pretty good fish these days.
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously just, you know, networking with people to find out or looking at, you know, there's plenty of different blogs out there. You know, if you want to look at fishing reports on Devil's Lake, you know, there's a group over there that is, you know, kind of saying like, you know, hey, you know, fish the highways, fish this section, you know, Tiger Bay has been good, this and that. So if you look at those reports for those particular bodies of water, usually the local bait shops will have some information for you. Yeah. I always joke, but you know, the barber shop has a lot of good information.
I'll tell you, whatever, you know, you do, get out and enjoy it. You know, we got this fishing right here in our backyard, you know, the river runs right through town. So, you know, people can get out and fish or adventure out. And I'll tell you, before you head out on those adventures, stop in here, Rocky Mountain Discount Sports, get all of your supplies just in case you can't find that hotel or motel.
Never a bad idea to have a tote with a lantern, a flashlight, a little backup stove, maybe an extra sleeping bag. I mean, whatever it takes, but we can certainly make those adventures a lot easier on you.
Well, of course, you can stop into the store on CY here in Casper, or you can actually go check them on Facebook. You guys have a Facebook page, and that you guys put sales and all that stuff up there too.
Yeah, a lot of times we're limited to what we can put on Facebook. You know, some of the stuff that we like to sell, the firearms and shooting accessories, we get per se shot down on allowing to post those.
Thanks, Zuckerberg.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, just trying to get the word out on, you know, what we carry in terms of, like, you know, the tents and the camping and the fishing and, you know, the paddle boards and that kind of stuff. A lot of people just, you know, have that, especially in Casper, have never even just been in our store,
right?
Which amazes me every day, you know. And the talk to people that said, "Oh yeah, I've lived here 30 years, never been in your store."
That's like, crazy.
I mean, I feel like you're sheltered. I mean, that means you're not outside enjoying life, because if you're outside enjoying these outdoors, you're gonna want to stop in here.
Absolutely. So go check them out on Facebook or RockyMountainSports.com online, or stop in here and check them out. CY Avenue in Casper. That's going to do it for another episode of Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. Go check out all of our episodes on demand right now at the radio station's app.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with Drew Kirby. If you have a question, want to make a comment, or have an idea for a show topic, message us on the My Country mobile app. Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.